provides an interactive platform for reports from the struggles for a world based on freedom, cooperation, justice and solidarity, and against environmental degradation, neoliberal exploitation, racism and patriarchy. The reports cover a wide range of issues and social movements, from neighborhood campaigns to grassroots mobilizations, from critical analysis to direct action. The content of the Indie Media UK website is created through a system of open publishing. Anyone can upload a written, audio and video report or a picture directly to the site through an openly accessible web interface. Through this system of direct media, Indie Media erodes the dividing line between reporters and reported, between active producers and passive audience. People are enabled to speak for themselves. That's from the Indie Media UK mission statement. Once articles have been uploaded to the site, it falls on a group of volunteer moderators who are members of the various collectives which make up the United Collectives, decide if a post breaches the editorial guidelines. Recently, this moderation process has become news in itself, as various sites have reported a difference within the collective about how to deal with a demand from Tony Greenstein of Jews Against Zionism that an article by Gilad Atzmon, later to be amended to all articles by Gilad Atzmon, be removed from the site. Tony Greenstein and Jews Against Zionism have spent a number of years campaigning against Gilad Atzmon and have tried to have him banned from a number of forums, including the Socialist Workers' Party, where he's played music and spoken, and the Pizza Express jazz clubs in London. To date, they haven't had any success. The demand from Greenstein for Atzmon to be banned from the Indie Media website has caused division within the collectives, with some members favouring a ban and others being against it. I met up with Gilad Atzmon on Friday the 30th of November in London, and this is the first of a two-part interview in which Gilad gives his side of the story. Hi, Gilad.
Hello. Very good to meet you after so much mess, man.
How would you describe yourself?
I'm primarily a jazz musician, and this would mean that I'm aiming towards creativity. I would like to see myself reinventing myself once a day. Obviously, it's not that easy. But to be a jazz musician or to be a jazz man means to be very sensitive, to be very observant and very attentive. And I would like to think that that's what my music is all about, and these writings are all about. I can see that my writings are different from many other contributors to the discourse. And I think that it is because I'm an artist, and basically a jazz artist. A lot of the things that I write, a lot of the ideas that I come up with are a product of a lot of reading, but as well a lot of self-reflection. So when I criticize Jewishness, it is primarily the Jew in me that I'm looking at. And I think that this is the reason that rather often, as you know, I'm labeled, but not a single person to date has managed to come with a profound criticism. So, you know, they will take things out of context and they will change... you know, they would doctor my writings, but then it is very counter-effective because once people go and read it, you know, they immediately see that it is on the verge of pure ideology.
If you're involved in self-reflection, you're looking into yourself, you're looking into what made you, what makes you, and trying to work out what you do with that.
Yeah, you know, my so-called five opponents are very annoyed by the fact that I'm so enthusiastic about Heidegger and Otto Weininger. I think that if we think about, you know, and I can understand, you know, they have, you know, they have to find a reason to start with, but there is, you know, Heidegger was a Nazi for a short while, and Otto Weininger was a misogynist and definitely an anti-Semite, a profound, you know, proud anti-Semite and a self-hater and whatever. I like Otto Weininger ideologically. I learn a lot from his idea. I come up with some different conclusions to Otto Weininger. But, for instance, what Otto Weininger is saying, which I find highly enlightening, is that we turn to hate that which we see in the other, but we recognize in ourselves and we don't like. We hate in the other that which we don't like in ourselves. And Otto Weininger, a genius, stood up and said, this is why we have so many Jewish anti-Semites. He said, most anti-Semites are actually Jews, because they see in the Jews something that they don't like in themselves. And Weininger is going even one step farther and arguing that Wagner... Sorry, too early in the day to think about, you know, that Wagner was actually a Jew. He came with a very interesting criticism of his musical talent and said that it was very Jewish, and this is why he was so antagonistic, so defiant against Jews. I read some other books about Wagner, and I don't know if this is the case. What is interesting is that actually Otto Weininger didn't regard Jewishness as a racial... If you take this, for instance, this idea about Wagner, you realize that he himself didn't see it as necessarily, I say, because there are some reason to argue otherwise. He didn't necessarily saw it. It didn't necessarily see it as a racial Jewishness, as a racial identity, but rather a cultural perception or characteristic or whatever. But when it comes to me learning from Weininger, I look into myself. I try to train myself to be better. And at the end of the day, I was born in Israel. I was supposed to become a soldier, to go to oppress Palestinians for 3 years, and then later to do it for 2 months a year till the age of 40, to every 7 years to go for a war and to kill Arabs. And it was a real process to understand A, how wrong it is, B, to turn the wrongness that is a product of self-realization into a message that I can share with others. So again, for me, it is a mirroring process. It wasn't always a mirroring process. In my early writings, I was writing about the Israelis, Jews. 4 or 5 years ago, I changed, you know. I don't see them very different from myself. And this is, and it is very interesting because I don't, as you know, my main opponents are Jewish Marxist, rather than Marxist who happen to be of Jewish origin, Jewish descent. The Jewish Marxist, those who really try to convince us that there is a viable political identity that is based on Jewishness. And I'm really they find me very annoying, because every criticism that I suggest to Zionism applies very much to them. It's an identity based on exclusiveness, segregation, it's non-universal, and that's what it is. Now, Zionists are not that annoyed by it, because they said, yeah, for sure we are not universal, you know, we want a Jewish state, what do you want more? But yeah, you would have a person like Mark Elf, that you actually learned at the rough side of him, about the rough side of him, you know, or Tony Greenstein, they form an exclusive political cell, and then once you tell them, sorry guys, what is the difference between you and your foes? They have nothing to say, so they rather prefer to label me as an anti-Semite. And, you know, nobody take them very seriously, you know? As it happened now in the UK, to be labeled by Aaronovitz as an anti-Semite, or by Tony Greenstein, is an entry card to the most prestigious humanist club. So, yeah, just never stop, please.
Right. Well, nevertheless, it seems to have caused some confusion within indie media. Now,
I'm fully aware
how much do you know about indie media?
I don't know that much about indie media. I never sent any of my stuff to indie media. In general, I circulate my papers to very small list of people. It is something between 20 to 60. And then my papers are circulated vastly. It starts the first day, I have something like 20 websites. 3 weeks later, 3 days later, it's 60 or 80, and then 600 websites and printed journals. And eventually, you know, one in the media would appear. A few years ago, I was promoted very favorably by Indie Media San Francisco. I don't know. I don't know if they are still active. What is happening? What happened
to
them?
A guy called Nessie.
Yeah.
Right.
Is he still around?
Nessie was, in my opinion, demonized until he was kind of forced out and that indie media was closed down.
Okay.
And the guy who particularly hounded him was Gehrig, who's come up in this...
This is the same Gehrig that is attacking me, basically.
Yeah.
All right, you see. This world is not that big.
No, that this particular...
Oh, you see, so even now, I don't know. So this was my only contact with indie media. I realized recently that Indie Media UK published quite a few of my work. Obviously, I never been involved with it. As you probably know, that I wasn't the one who sent it to Indie Media. I don't even know who did. The reason that I myself don't send papers to places like Indie Media is because I don't believe in bodies that are acting as board of directors or moderators. I'm not against it, you know, but as we just mentioned, the example of San Francisco, they were doing a good job. And then, you know, within a kind of a simple political manipulative putsch, you can change it radically. As we could see what this Tony Greenstein or Mark Elper are trying to do, or Machover or whoever, I really believe in editorials. In editorials, an editor that make up a decision and take responsibility for it. I don't believe in, you know, papers that are uploaded and then can be deleted. You know, I believe in freedom of speech, and my belief in freedom of speech means as well that I don't really believe in boycotting Israeli. I would invest my energy in letting Palestinian, you know, do whatever we can to let Palestinian academics and Palestinian general travel in the world. We try to have now a conference with Palestinian. We couldn't get a single Palestinian to come to Italy. You know, it was in Italy, single one. You know, and I find it devastating. I don't know how we managed, how did I get that far talking about the... freedom of speech. I as well believe that Irving should have freedom of speech. I believe that people should never be locked for what they think. People should be locked for what they do. If they incite racial hatred, immediately, behind bars, for sure. But people who read history, you know, so... Again, we get to the same place, you know. I want to deal, and this with the people that I'm dealing with editorials who are taking responsibility. You know, there was these accusations against me that some right wing, I wasn't familiar with any right wing, and then this was the issue of David Duke website. You know, apparently David Duke publishes Lenny Brenner. He publishes what suits his agenda, you know. But people ask me, why didn't you ask him? No, I'm not going to ask anyone. I'm not going to ask. My writings and my music belongs, that's the way I want to say it, belong to the public once it leaves my computer or the studio or whatever. It belongs to the public. It doesn't belong to me anymore. If you want to publish it and you make money out of it, so yeah, you will have to pay me something, so I get, you know, some royalties. But if you put it on the net, I made a decision, and I hope that one day I'll be able to do the same with my music as well. You know, just to give it free, you know, it's yours.
You were brought up in Israel.
Yeah.
And I remember one article I read, you talked about being an adolescent and about being quite consumed by the whole experience of being Israeli, by the, you know, that you bought into things at that stage, is that?
Yeah. As a youngster, I was raised in a very, very Zionist environment. I would even say right-wing Zionist environment. Mind you, in my house, in my parents' library, you know, we had a big library, a lot of shelves, you know, full with books. We had the entire list of Jabotinsky writing, the most radical, racist, Zionist author, yet an amazing writer. And it took me some time to realize that actually Jabotinsky, ideologically, was far more advanced. Far more advanced than Ben Gurion, for instance. It took me some time to realize that from a humanist point of view, Jabotinsky had far more respect to Arabs, to the indigenous Palestinians, than the Zionist left. And this is why he invented the Iron Wall. He said, these Arabs are people with culture, they are people with history, they are people who have, you know, will confront our national identity and then their national will emerge consequently. And this is why we have to build an iron wall of fierceness. Now, it is not surprising that Avi Shlem, who is one of the most important historians of the region or of the conflict, he came with this idea, the Iron Wall, like 10 years ago. Oh my God, it's basically Zionism was following Jabotinsky, was, you know, pretending to be left, which is a nice trick. You know, we see Tony Grinson is doing the same. You know, he pretends to be left, but he's a Islamophobe racist, acting in exclusive cells. You know, because somehow, and this is something very interesting, quite a few politically orientated Jews believe that being lefty is more sexy. Now, I have written about it, I didn't publish it yet, for the last 4 decades at least. The Palestinian discourse was dominated by the left. So, we have nice badges, and we have kind of nice scarves, Palestinian scarves, and we have kind of a new Palestinian cups. We can drink our lavatsa in the morning. We have all the lefty fetish elements. Yet, we didn't manage to save a single Palestinian. We didn't bring justice to Palestine. We didn't manage to stop a single Merkava tank from flattening, you know, a Palestinian village, or we didn't save any F-16, you know, from throwing bombs on the most highly populated places. The most highly populated place on this planet. We didn't bring justice to Palestine following this agenda. And I'm not against the left philosophy. I just think that we have good reason to say this really exclusive activism has failed. And rather than saying, now let's give, you know, a way to write, and this is not what I'm saying. I'm saying the real reason that people want to support Palestine is because they watch Newsnight and they see the most devastating scenes in front of their eyes and say, we want to do something. So it's the very empathic instinct that is turning into an ethical awareness. And this is why we have to work on ethical base rather than to follow an ideology that basically died 100 years ago. So I work a lot with left organizations. I don't work with any right wing organization. You know, I'm you know, touring a lot for the SWP without being a member and while declaring that I'm not a Marxist. But for me, it's ethics. Ethics. They fit into my ethical perception. Not all the way, not entirely. I have some serious disputes on several issues with the SWP, and I'll have to make up my mind, obviously. I have to make up my mind, not them. Mm-hmm.
Going back to the question I asked you when we kind of went off track.
Yeah.
Growing up in Israel, what was the message you got about anti-Semitism?
Okay, this is a very, very interesting question, actually. And I'm about to write about it. As the next paper, you just, I think, read my paper about the diaspora Jew. The next paper is about the psychosis of the Israeli. Basically, before 67, and I agree about it with Finkelstein, Holocaust wasn't a big issue, and anti-Semitism wasn't a big issue. Why? Because we wanted to be proud Israelis, strong. You have your Uzi machine gun or automatic rifle, I don't know what is the exact English definition. And you don't even, you know, the Israeli shoots from the hips with the Uzi. Do you know the image?
Yeah.
You know, like a normal soldier, try to see, you know, the Israeli shoot from the hip because it doesn't matter. You know, you shoot in the direction of your enemy, i.e. Arabs. So within such a proud and arrogant self-perception, there was no room for victimhood. Things change around 67, maybe a bit later, the War of Attrition, 69, 71, or maybe even 73. This interesting Abba Eben attack on Chomsky is 73, and this is probably the first time that anti-Semitism is identified with anti-Zionism, or anti-Zionism is equated with as a new form of anti-Semitism or whatever. Now we have to ask ourselves what really happened there. First, from 73, okay, from 67, after 67, after the great victory, the Israelis became the heroes. They managed to defeat, I don't know, 3-4 Arab armies, if you include Iraq as well. In 6 days, the Holocaust has become a vehicle, a political vehicle. It was, you know, oh, you know, we did it because we don't have any other choice. You know, people really want to demolish us. Oh, yo. This is about the introduction of the oi into the Israeli political discourse. 73 was regarded by Israelis as as another disaster that almost led to the erasure of Israeli of the regional map. And then we had Lebanon War, where Menachem Begin, I was a soldier at the time, this is where Menachem Begin made a real equation between the kids of Kiryat Shmona, it's a town in northern Israel, and the kids who died in Auschwitz or in the Holocaust. And this is basically the moment where Israelis start to see themselves rather as the follower of their biblical Israelite, they start to see themselves as the survivor of the Holocaust. And this is where they identify more with the European past. And this is why eventually they build a ghetto wall around themselves, which means the cancellation of one of the biggest achievements of the French Revolution, the emancipation of the Jews. So they say, thank you very much, we want to go back to the ghetto. Now, if you read the early Zionists, you can see that they are very nostalgic about the ghetto. A few days ago, a Palestinian academic, maybe you have seen it, raised the issue of memory and nostalgia on Peace Palestine. And he said, oh, you see, Gilad, you and me, you know, we are from the same land and the memory and our nostalgia. And I told him, you know, my memory goes to Palestine, but my nostalgia goes to Europe. So the Israelis have short memory of their life in Palestine, but nostalgically, they want back the ghetto wall, the Jewish concentrated area, you know, this all kind of peace farce that we have last week is how to maintain the Jewish state and to stop the demographic disaster that is clearly awaiting the Jewish state. So within this concept, the Israeli, and this is what I didn't write in my paper, this is my next paper, moved from the proud new Israeli nationalist, the Sabra. Man who can defend, yeah, the Sabra, which we can talk about the Sabra, which is a very interesting concept. The Sabra, I was born as a Sabra. I was born as a Sabra, and I see people in my age and their kids are now talking about third generation of Holocaust victims and fourth generation people in my age, you know. So, theoretically speaking, if I would be still in Israel as a proper kind of Israeli citizen, I would say, yeah, yeah, because I can get you as many Holocaust stories, you know. If I look under the carpet, I find I'm from a European origin, you know. For me, being an Israeli, is it not something that I'm fighting Israel, but I cannot change, there's not a lot I could do to clear past, you know. I was born in Israeli. I was raised as a Sabra, as a proud man. I wasn't there to become victim. But Israel is now moving more and more into this victimhood identity. And it's very, very interesting. So I now present a new level of dialectic between the diaspora. The diaspora wants to be Israeli, but the Israeli want to be diaspora. It is very interesting.
Yeah.
It is very interesting. Now, the another thing that you have to bear in mind, the cues for Polish, Romanian, East European passports in Israel is huge. Why? They want to have European passport so they can go whenever they like.